The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Case number 38 in the Gateless Gate collection. Wutsu Fayan said, "It's like a water buffalo passing through the window. Nose, horns, four hooves, they all lumber slowly through. But then, how is it the tail never goes past?" And Wu Men's comment, "You here before me in this Sangha, if you can turn things upside down, revealing Buddha-eye clarity whole, and then conjure a hinge phrase, you'll requite the four forms of loving-kindness and preserve the three realms of existence. If you're free from doubt, you'll see with perfect clarity exactly where that tale begins." And his poem, "If it goes past, it falls into a ditch. If it comes back, it's all shambles. A wisp of tail, seen with absolute clarity, what strange wonder it is." So this koan is considered a very difficult koan for Zen students. Hakuin Zenji, who lived in the 17th century and organized the koans into a form of study, what we call our koan curriculum, in which our koan curriculum is derived from, his koan groupings, said there were 9 koans that were difficult to pass, and this was one of them. Any of you who encounter koans in Doksan may argue with him. Not that this one's particularly difficult or easy, but that there are only 9 that are difficult. And this koan is a very important one in our study of Zen, because it speaks to a very common delusion in spiritual practice in general, in Buddhism in particular, and even though we talk about it quite a bit, it still sneaks in to our understanding of this great way. So before I talk about the koan much, I want to look at Wu Men's comment first and then his poem and then go back to the main case. So Wu Men says, "You here before me in this Sangha, if you can turn things upside down, revealing Buddha-eye clarity whole, and then conjure a hinge phrase, you'll requite the four forms of loving-kindness and preserve the three realms of existence. If you're free from doubt, you'll see with perfect clarity exactly where that tale begins." So right away, he addresses all of us, "You here before me." All of us here together, practicing together. All of us doing our best. And all of us plagued by what one of you called in Doksan this morning, the kerfuffle of the mind. I love the word kerfuffle. It's very descriptive, I think, of the way most of our minds work. For those of you who don't know that word in English, I think you can guess what it means. It's everything is kind of a mess. Everything is all over the place. And here we are, outwardly sitting with a very simple, straightforward form. But inside, all kinds of stuff going on. All kinds of ideas about Zen, about ourselves, about other people, about the way the world works. And Wu Men challenges us here. He says, if you can turn things upside down. So upside down is a way of talking about what my first teacher used to call the upside down kingdom, which is what happens when we have been sitting long enough that we stop believing our minds. We stop putting a lot of faith in the kerfuffle. Instead, we ground ourselves in our upright posture, in our breathing, in our body, in the coming and going of all the sense perceptions and emotions and thoughts, but not fixating on any of them. Learning to know that they themselves are not it, although they also are it. And that's the way Zen works. Everything is it. And we can get lost so easily. Both things are true. So when we turn things upside down, the clearest explanation to me of this actually came from Sun San's teachings, David's teacher's teacher, Sun Sanim, who used to draw a big circle on the blackboard. Some of you may not know what blackboards are, but you can ask me about that at Doksan another time. Just a big screen where you used a marker to make words and pictures. He would, make a big circle and say at the top of the circle is zero and halfway down is whatever half of 360 is. And then all the way back up, I guess 180, and then all the way back up to 360, which is the same as zero. Many other Zen teachers have used this analogy, including Joshu Sasaki Roshi. I once heard a nearly unintelligible talk by him about it. And basically, straightforwardly, it's that after you've been sitting for a while, things turn upside down. We reach the bottom of the circle, the 180 degrees opposite zero, and everything we've ever thought we knew is upended. There's an upheaval. This is what we've been calling awakening or opening the eye or opening to the way reality is. At this point, everything is mysterious and not what we thought it was, not what we all the plans we've made about being awake fall away at that point because there's no way we could have conceptualized it. Everything is upside down. And then, after that, we begin the ascent back to zero, to 360. We complete the circle. And the work of getting from 180 to 360 is the work of the chisel that Alan was talking about yesterday. The work of going from zero to 180 is also the work of the chisel. But in that moment when we reach the upside-down kingdom, who cares about circles, numbers, degrees, chisels, awls? All of it disappears. And there's just this. Resonating fully. We come up with all kinds of ways of pointing to this, just this experience. So Wu Men's calling it upside down now, the 180 point of the circle, Mu, the single hand, the moon reflected in the water, all of these different things, the great mirror wisdom, the shattering of the mirror, these are all the metaphors, some of the metaphors we've been looking at to describe this place of being upside down. And there are other koans that specifically talk about upside down. Once somebody asked Jiaozhou, what is the teaching of the Buddhas and ancestors? And he said, one teaching upside down. So letting ourselves get to the upside down kingdom, not everyone wants to go there. It feels kind of scary. It feels like falling off the edge of a cliff, maybe in our speculations about it. But actually, when it happens, it's not even such a big deal. It's just, oh, or it could be sometimes, oh, but most of the time it's, huh, oh, little moments of awakening. The awl has punctured the cloth, the leather, and we have a view of some other world. So a woman here calls it revealing Buddha eye clarity whole. And this is another way of talking about the upside down. Clarity, this pristine clarity, this wholeness, the Buddha eye, the awakened eye, the part of us that has always seen the way the world is. And doesn't believe it or forgets it or runs away from it or on the other hand makes a fetish of it and makes a story up about it. But in this moment it's just this clear seeing, the Buddha eye clarity whole. So he says, woman says, if you can turn things upside down, revealing Buddha eye clarity whole, and then conjure a hinge phrase. This is another way of talking about a turning word. Conjure something up, make something up, create something that will be a little reminder, not just to you, but to everyone who encounters the way and tries to find a way to put it into language. A hinge phrase, sometimes a wado is another way of talking about this. Something that is the heart of the koan, the kernel from which the whole koan rises up. Mu is the hinge phrase or the wado or the turning word of the koan mu, for example. So we sit with mu and we let mu act upon us. We don't need to do anything but invite mu in, and it does all the work. So if you do all that, then you get to have a life in the world. And he describes this as requiting the four forms of loving kindness and preserving the three realms of existence. So these four forms of loving kindness are, unlike in the Theravada school, they have a different meaning in Zen from its Confucian and Taoist roots in China. So they're sometimes called the four roots of love, the four roots of loving kindness, the four roots of obligations, the four roots of gratitude, the four forms of gratitude. And the first gratitude, strangely, I think some Westerners and especially Americans may struggle with this one. It's gratitude to our parents. We may have had problematic parents, so it's hard to feel gratitude towards them. But this is a gratitude that's deeper than any history we have with our parents. It's the fact that a man and a woman got together and created you. And then maybe something else happened after that. Someone else took over your care. You had parents who were not the original man and woman seed and egg that produced you. So these are your parents. The people who loved you, maybe it was a grandparent, the people who took care of you when you were helpless, the people who, at the end of our lives, will take care of us again when we're helpless, will the people who change our diapers and pick us up when we're inconsolable with grief and hunger and sleepiness and pain, who feed us and rock us and love us. So this is the first form of the four gratitudes, the four obligations, as we would say in Confucian Chinese. And then the second one might be even harder these days. I can remember a time when this made sense to me, but boy, it's a struggle right now. But I'll do my best to interpret it for you so that you can also be grateful. It's to our country, to our sovereign, which is really interesting depending on where you live. So, of course, the meaning of this is not to say USA all the way or make America great again or anything like that, but to realize that our native place, which maybe is a better translation, our native place, we have parents or caretakers or the loving ones who took care of us when we were helpless, and we live somewhere. We came from someplace. And wherever that is, it's our home. The trees and the flowers and the mountains and the valleys of our home. We will, no matter where we travel, always recognize that native place. And the people who take care of that native place for us, which is not just the sovereign or the president or the king or the emperor, but everyone who maintains the place. We couldn't do it all, just like we can't maintain our own bodies by ourselves. We can't beat our hearts or circulate our blood or have our immune system function, although sometimes we think we can, and then we get in all kinds of trouble. Imagine just having a second of thinking you were in charge of your body. You did all your liver functions and your kidney functions and beat your heart and oh my goodness, you'd be dead in a second. So we trust in this bigger form of benevolent interaction that we call where we live. So all the people who take care of everything, the streets and the plows today, the people who plowed the streets and sanded so that we could drive on the roads, the guy who came last night and plowed us, all the people who dug out today here at the temple and elsewhere, we couldn't do it by ourselves. So we are dependent and we have to be grateful to our native place and all the people who make our survival possible. And then the third obligation is to the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Without the awakened heart of the Buddha, without the Dharma, the teachings coming to us from our ancestors, from our current teachers, from each other, without the Sangha, the community of practice, we wouldn't be able to survive. So far, the parents, our original caretakers, our native place, and everyone who contributes to the functioning of that place, and the three jewels, we could not survive without them. And the fourth is all beings. Because if we're honest, the first three are a bit exclusionary. Every single being makes our existence possible. Every single sentient being and non-sentient being. Without the floor, we just fall to the earth. Without the air, we wouldn't survive for more than a moment. The stones and the trees and the birds singing and all the people, the ants, the sticks, the grizzly bears that we chant to in our dedication, all things, without exception, allow us to be who we are. And so Wumen says, if you do this thing, it's not, awakening is not just some fun thing to do and then I'll go back to my sorry life. It actually changes everything. It requites the four obligations, the four gratitudes. It makes human life possible. Our contribution to this endless web of care and love is to practice and see through our delusions. And then it also preserves the three realms of existence, which is another Zen teaching about the world, the three worlds we call them, the world of form, the world of no form, and the world of desire, which are sometimes talked about in various ways. But basically it's another way of saying we sustain everything through our own awakening. And then he says, if you're free from doubt, if you know this for yourself, if you have tasted the water and you know whether it's cold or warm, if you have felt the coolness on your own face, if you have seen the sunlight and the colors of the flowers, if you have experienced the world directly, you will see with perfect clarity exactly where that tail begins. And here we come back to the tail of the ox who goes through the lattice window. So this is an impossible thing, a huge ox going through a window, a water buffalo in this translation. A water buffalo going through a window, a lattice window, a delicate, fragile window. It goes through, and its head goes through, and its horns go through, its nose goes through, its four hooves go through. They all, in this great David Hinton translation, they all lumber slowly by. And this is an image of awakening. We have gotten through to the other side. We've gotten to the upside-down kingdom. We've gotten to the upside-down kingdom, but we haven't yet gotten back to the beginning, to our true home, to our original dwelling place, as it says in another koan. We haven't gotten back to the life that has taken the seeming opposites of relative and absolute, of form and emptiness, of chisel and awl, and created one wholeness. The Buddha eye revealing clarity whole. This is the image of the water buffalo getting through to the other side, complete around the circle, form and emptiness, one thing, returning to the marketplace with bliss-bestowing hands. But wait a minute, the tail can't get through. What's that about? And that, of course, is the crux of the whole problem. We think that this awakening is some kind of pristine, perfect clarity. The water buffalo goes all the way through. We make it around the circle completely. We have no more problems, no more issues. All of the things that we've thought have gotten in our way have disappeared. But that's not how it works, because remember, everything is the Buddha nature without exception. So that means all of your kerfuffle of your mind is, in fact, the awakened nature manifesting itself as kerfuffle. All of your mistakes and dumb things that we say and do, and all of our desires and confusions, and all of it, without exception, is the Buddha nature. And if we don't know that, and believe me, people get fooled by hearing about awakening, by even having an experience of awakening. Oh, great, I'm free, dancing around, never any problems again, nothing in my way, ever again. Oh my goodness, we call that the Zen sickness. It's a problem. Thank goodness for the little tiny tail. Sometimes not so tiny, sometimes a huge tail that wraps itself around us and tries to strangle us. It's so painful to be human, and also so joyous, and also so ordinary, and also so simple and complicated, and all of it. So woman ends by saying, if it goes past, it falls into a ditch. If you are the water buffalo and you think, I'm free, and if it comes back, it's all a shambles. Another way of saying kerfuffle. A wisp of tail. In another translation, this tiny little tail, a wisp of tail, seen with absolute clarity, what strange wonder it is. Other translations say how marvelous it is, how wonderful it is, how great that we cannot perfect ourselves according to our little limited idea of perfection. Instead, we get to taste the great Buddha perfection, which excludes nothing, includes everything. Wu Tzu Fayan said, it's like a water buffalo passing by the window, passing through your window. Nose, horns, four hooves, they all lumber slowly through. But then, how is it that the tail never goes past. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable, and we'll have our Dharma dialogue. Remember that we're being recorded, and so if you want us to turn it off, let us know.
For me, I don't think it would be a sesshin if at some point something didn't get under my skin. And the longer I sit with the Sangha and go to sesshin, it seems to be that's a rarer occurrence. Things that maybe I find unpleasant or irritable don't really seem to matter, and they disappear pretty quickly. But sure enough, you got me again. And while I was lying in my bunk watching the dust sparkle in the sunlight, I got to really just watch this cascade of emotions and thoughts turn into what felt like love and gratitude, and coming back into the Zendo, I found myself at a deeper level of surrender to the practice. And even with some heightened focus, and you could feel it. I could feel it in my upper chest, and that's going through the circle. And sure enough, that just fades down and dims back into the grind of the practice. As that happened, you gave this really lovely and powerful and resonating talk. You kind of lost me at the gratitude for the parents thing.
But yeah, no problem.
There's work to be done.
There's work to be done.
So there it is, just going around in a circle, and I can feel it again in my chest. And I know that this won't last, and I'm just going to be back to the grind. But going around this circle is pretty nifty.
Nifty, did you say?
Yeah,
yeah, it is nifty.
And so thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Well, and I so appreciate you talking about what sesshin is really like. I mean, it is designed to get under our skin. And at first we think that's a problem. We think, well, if I practice long enough, then this or that. And so some of us can hold out quite a while. I'm fine. And then, somebody starts walking and it's really irritating. or something terrible like that. But this opportunity to see it arise, it is so precious. Because we are so convinced that we are right. And in this container, there creates a little separation. So we see the pattern. Like, oh, irritation. And there's just a little bit more space to hold it and allow it to be what it is. You didn't think, okay, this is up now, I'm going to transform this sucker, and I'm going to be... But just in being with the irritation, we don't do it. You didn't do it. You did nothing. And that's the incredible thing, that this in this upside-down world that we've carefully delineated... This is good, this is bad. We see the aliveness of life, and then things transform, and this irritation somehow turns into some gratitude or something so precious. And I love the, as you say, the ongoing nature, once more around the washing machine. Right? And then we see that, so then our freedom is in every part of this. And each time we see it, there is some deeper confidence of this, because it will come again and it will appear, but we have more faith in some way that, oh yeah, this is the part where I'm irritated, right? And I don't have to do anything. So thank you, Michael. Wonderful.
I kept thinking of the ungraspable trace, which is very mysterious and wonderful. And I was thinking about what came to mind was Josh when he gave a Dharma talk at Sesshin, where he was talking about atonement and this triangle, like of, I don't really know how to describe it, but it made an impression on me that made me understand that I don't have to get it right. I don't have to do everything right, even though I still carry that with me. I carry, oh gosh, oh, didn't, you know, oh, why did I, you know, but it just helped me. It just offered a little more spaciousness of maybe looking at that, maybe room for it to turn upside down at that time and it continues.
Yeah. Well, I would add, you know, it's not only that you don't have to get it right, you can't get it right. It's impossible. Right. We just don't ever have enough information to make the right decisions about anything. So we do our best. We blunder, and then we say, oh.
Well, there's still this part of my mind, even though I hear the information that I can't get it right, you know, I hear the words, I hear the truth that I can't, I still have an impulse. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it speaks, I felt it more in the impulse sense of things in my body of, like, and also, you know, there's so much more. There's so much more else, other in life to experience than always being on that edge of it. So I just want to say that, yes.
And to appreciate even this ancient arising of, I have to get it right, or that is the arising of the Dharma itself, right? So this is not, well, I have to get rid of my self-judgment, or I have to get rid of those old impulses, right? But really appreciating here, yeah, just like this. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
But are we always on the edge regardless? When she mentioned, I feel like I'm on the edge all the time.
Yeah.
Are we always on the edge regardless?
What's your experience with that?
Yes, pretty much.
Yeah, and on the edge of what? Just say a little more, because I think this
is occasionally there's moments of clarity when the world just seems just going along just fine on its own without my help.
Yeah.
And then other times when I see peril, you know, I see my own confused thinking coming back, no matter how hard I try for it not to happen. And I know that in itself is a problem, trying not to make something happen. So anyways, I feel like I'm on this kind of edge as I live my normal life.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have a wispy tail?
I have a wispy tail.
Right, how marvelous. What would you do without that?
I would fall into the ditch.
Yeah.
That's right.
Right, right.
That's right.
Yeah, this, some teachers have talked about running along the ridge or the knife edge. You know, I'm always almost falling into delusion.
Mm-hmm.
And again, how marvelous.
Forgetting
that. Well, I mean, right, because going back to what Joanne said, it doesn't feel good.
Yeah.
Right? So to say how marvelous.
I like it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, thank you very much.
I really appreciate the talk. Thank you so much. It's beautiful. There's one little jewel in the middle of it that I just want to, describe or I don't know, just make us think about it a little, which is the, there are actually two, I think, that the, maybe it's the idealized parents, you know, who love us and feed us, change our diapers or whatever, you know, without pay, without
without
pay, without thanks, it's sort of this perfection. I mean, what an incredible gift to to receive that. So that's one jewel, you know. And then another is this world that, you know, this place that nourishes us and takes care of us and keeps us, you know, going. And for me, one of those images is the sun that, you know, every day, if it's not blocked by clouds, shines light and warmth on us. And, you know, no pay back. No, you know, it's just, so it's another jewel. There are these couple of jewels in the middle of what you were saying that are really special. And then, you know, it makes me think about our experience of meditating in this 360 degrees that, that maybe we can have a little taste of it, but we can't hold, I can't hold that. That jewel.
Thank you for bringing those two points back, because they were intriguing for me when I did a little research on this koan, because, you know, I've known this koan for a really long time. It's such an important teaching about the tail. And, you know, but this other part, that if you do this, you're actually, one of the things we recognize, because we're recognizing wholeness, is that we could not survive without this big web of interconnection that holds us all. And it includes, you know, the people who didn't get their diapers changed and they didn't survive, right? And the countries that don't work, you know, where everybody's fighting and there's terrible stuff going on, that people are not surviving. So this is those of us who are alive and well enough to be at a sesshin right now. How could you help but be grateful if you actually pay attention, right? And then that there's power for the way, as we like to say. So the obligations or the gratitudes or whatever you want to call them, they empower our practice. The sun, thank you. I don't even get minimum wage, but I'm grateful, right? And everything. I mean, it's kind of wonderful to walk through the world with this kind of gratitude. The real tricky thing is to be grateful. So that's easy in a way. To be grateful for the crappy appearing stuff, right? The things that are really awful, you know, the irritating things. How can you be grateful for them? They're also manifestations of the great way. So almost like to practice recognizing that I don't know what's good or bad, but, you know, I can be grateful.
And I was struck by this requiting.
Yeah.
So it's partly recognizing how much we've all been given, just immeasurable, right? No way to repay your parents. No way to repay the sun. But that when we wake up and when we live in this life, this is how we requite the love. This is how we pay it forward, by seeing clearly and living in the world as bodhisattvas, not for minimum wage, not for paying. When we live this way, there's no such thing as payback. It's not in a world like that. Well, I'll go do some good things today so people will say thank you. No, I see how much I love people and how connected I am. So, of course, right? And we enter this world not in an instrumental negotiation way, but the freedom, as you say, the joy that then you are the light, I am the light. This is how we repay the sun.
So
I want to go back to the tail. A little bit louder. The tail that is stuck. And also arguing that maybe we're not quite at the place where we feel gratitude, but the touching and allowing to be touched by the messiness and the awfulness as we fall into delusion, and just trying to be curious about what it is that is here. You know, we might have this idea that there's a messiness or that it's difficult or that the parental relationship is difficult. But to something about the touching and being touched and not really knowing quite what is there, and it's quite possible that the response then will be a softening and some kind of sense of appreciation. But for me, it's the first step has been to allowing the touching and being touched and be curious what's there in even difficult.
Yes.
Does that make any sense? So not necessarily a full-on gratitude right away?
Oh, no. You can't pretend to be grateful. Yeah.
Right.
But through the practice.
And different states and different degrees of that.
So you can't pretend to be grateful, but through the practice, gratitude arises naturally. If you try to force it, I think that's what you're pointing to.
And to appreciate the degrees of joy, the degrees of appreciation that we encounter along the way, and to notice that and honor that as something too.
Go ahead.
What was coming up for me, Esther, is, you know, that great line in the Bodhisattva's vow, which is not we should try to be grateful, but how can we be ungrateful to anyone or anything? And so that's the other part of it. That's what arises out of the Bodhisattva heart. We can't be ungrateful. You know, we can try. How can we be ungrateful to anyone or anything? So no degrees anymore, right? Just pure outflow. And as Melissa just said, totally natural. So there's also that.
Mm-hmm. And in the forms of Zen practice, we actually practice gratitude all the time. We come into the Zendo and we bow to the altar. We don't have to feel like, oh, thank you so much. You've been waiting here for me. You're the representation of the awakened heart. Oh, thanks. Nope, we just come in and do that motion. We bow to our seat, which is where the teachings arise, you know, through the wildness of our life. And then we bow to the Sangha. We do that. I think that's one of the reasons why the four obligations include the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Because, as Ellen said, I love that, turning it around. How could we possibly be ungrateful? And yet, that's a formulation that comes through our minds. So we're practicing gratitude all the time when we do it, but not through some fakey, isn't this great that I'm having a really hard day? These people are such jerks or whatever. Yeah. Instead, it's like, all right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yep. Okay. Oof. Whatever, right?
Well, and I think tying it back to what Michael was saying about the complaint and the irritation, if you are trying to be a good student, when the irritation comes up, you'll try to ride over it. Yeah. Well, this doesn't bother me. I'm just going to shut down. So with our parents, we really honor how angry we are at them, how hurt we have been. And so we begin appreciation of being with what is true, which is so different than, I'm grateful to my parents, I'm grateful to my parents, I'm grateful. Right? But the reality of it, and then looking into that, trusting that whatever is arising is not something that gratitude covers over. But in that very woundedness, in that very, you know, how could they not, how could they do this to me, is how we find our way in. I hear some of that, what you're saying about the suchness of whatever it is that comes up. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm not sure how much this has to do with the koan itself, but what it's bringing up for me, especially in this discussion of parents, is turning that around the other way. Being a parent, and, you know, doing all those things for a helpless infant, sometimes there's resentment.
Right?
Yes. And I can remember very clearly a very small baby screaming, and it was really important to me what part of him I looked at.
Mm-hmm.
If I looked at that wide open toothless mouth screaming, I just, you know,
yeah.
Like this. But if I look at those eyes clenched in pain or whatever, it was like a whole different thing. It was, you could appreciate that kind of pain. But it took that flippant perspective to, you know.
It's a beautiful example of the turning it upside down.
Yeah, really nice.
You know, and then just linking back to Esther's comments, that also we can just be really resentful and just hate that little screaming blob of flesh and still pick it up and comfort it, right? That doesn't mean that we can act through our upset, and then we have some responsibility. I always remember when my brother, who's older than I am, but we had babies at the same time, and he mine was 3 months older, so he called me up one day and he said, "Honey, I have to ask you a question. So is it normal for me to want to take my beautiful little girl and throw her out the window?" And I said, "It is normal." I said, "You're not going to do it, are you?" "Oh, no, I just want to know if it was normal. Thanks." Yeah. And so the owning of everything, right? Everything is the Buddha nature. Our resentments, our anger, our not being grateful. It's a wash. And it's also very particular. Some things are harder than others. I think that's what you're pointing to as well. Yeah. So did you see something?
Kelsey.
Oh, Kelsey.
Maybe right. Last one. Yeah.
Yep.
For me, I really love the analogy of the sun. I think it brings up a lot for me just because I find so much joy, like, when I'm out in the sun, especially on a chilly day like today. But sort of thinking about the reverse, and as a fair-skinned person, I've had my fair share of sunburns.
Right.
And so sometimes it's like something that has, like, so much joy can also cause so much pain just by the essence of, like, what it is. And so it's just interesting to me that, like, just because of the interaction I have with the sun doesn't change what the sun is. Like, it is what it is.
Yeah.
But in this complicated world we live in, you know, our reactions and responses and interactions just constantly change.
Right. Yeah. Right, the sun is actually getting to be a problem in some places, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, and to appreciate, we can take these phrases or these ideas, and if we hold on to it too tightly, we get sunburned. Oh, the sun is wonderful. It's free. So I love really keeping opening, appreciating. Oh, yeah, it's free. And it's also many things. So holding that openness. Well, what is it now? How do I need to be in relation? Well, I better get my hat on. Right? Yeah.
Mm. That's a really important point, you know, that we become more and more free to respond to things without putting them in boxes. Sun is good, sun is bad. Parents are good, parents are bad. Just now what? Mm-hmm. Now what?
And having grown up in Seattle, there's something to be said for the clouds, too.
Yeah. And with that, we'll come back to our sitting.